Thank you.
Thanks.
See, Dave, every time I get a grant, the Attorney General throws a bunch of curveballs my way on varying issues. So, to address...
Well, in fairness to you, you have a lot going on in that case.
Yes.
This was probably the least of your worries at the time.
It was. Kind of threw me for a curveball, and I get a grant from the Court of Appeals, and it's on the misdemeanor. I'm like, huh? What? All right, so first, the first issue I think I have to deal with is the 5A18 waiver. I think I can sort of like address that a little bit. Assuming without conceding, because I'll acknowledge that the actual full analysis of the statute was not done in front of the lower court. This is one of those rare things that even at motion to strike, trial counsel sort of like brushed the misdemeanor aside, and the bulk of the colloquy involving the misdemeanor was between the judge and the actual prosecutor, and going back and forth regarding varying arguments, and essentially the trial judge only let the one involving abandonment go forward, leaving the kids at the store. So putting aside the statutory analysis for a moment, just dealing with what the abandonment and his explanation. The next issue I think the Commonwealth threw my way is whether or not procedural bar. Now, looking at it, I do not profess to be any sort of expert by any stretch of the imagination, but in perusing the code, I have found only 38 references to the word abandoned, only one of which had any sort of definition attached to it, and that is under involving deserting, forsaking, or giving up an animal, and that is under 3.2-6500, and that was after 4 days. Now, even as a defense attorney, there's no way I'm going to suggest that you have to wait 4 days for a child to be abandoned. I mean, I think that's an absurd result. Abandonment occurs, I think, like 121 different times in the code, but I couldn't find any major definition. So, in fairness, I don't think the code actually defines abandonment, and even perusing the case law, I couldn't find anything directly on point that dealt with abandonment. 18.2371 is sort of like unusual, and that it references 16.1228 has five different things that it could potentially fall under.
But there is a difference between abandonment and unreasonable absence as used in this particular code section.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But the indictment did not specify which of those theories would support the charge. Is that right?
It does not. It just sort of lists...
General code section.
But just like this court is sort of like bound by the record as far as like, and I can't argue anything as far as what is the trial court didn't actually consider, I think this court is also bound by that. So even though the trial judge on his own considered essentially is dealing with the abandonment issue, I think that also forecloses this court from saying, well, it also could be an unreasonable absence, because the trial judge, in reviewing everything and looking at the multiple theories, that unlike the case in Miller, where it's sort of going through, or even the unpublished opinion of Embre, where the trial judge did not make any specificity as far as the word the code section followed under, this court then said, well, it could go under alternate theories. That's not the case here. The trial judge said the only theory proceeding under is abandonment. The unreasonable absence, as this court dealt with in Miller, I think is sort of at least instructive. Because there, even though there's not a large time frame that I was dealing with there, I think in reviewing the facts, leaving the child in the car, going out, going the very different, I think, people that testified to, one of the co-workers, another co-worker, the store manager, I think even on a conservative basis, we're looking at close to about an hour and a half, even though it wasn't generally specified. Here, and we're dealing with more of like an infant in that particular case. Here, we're dealing with older children. We're dealing with a 10, 12, 13 years old at the time. And Buddy Dollarheit, the store manager, because that's what we're dealing with here, said that the kids were in his office for 30 minutes. Now, we don't know how long they're running around. Outside of that, it's just in the office for 30 minutes. And the record is sort of, and I acknowledge the trial judge found my client guilty, which by definition, it seems he rejected his sort of like explanation. Now, to be fair, I don't think he dealt with a whole lot regarding the explanation as it relates to the misdemeanors versus the more serious offenses. But even taking that as a whole, what we have here as Bunny Dalloway indicated, my clients came in and said he was sleeping in the truck, made no reference of a phone call that Jacob Dillon said it made to get him to come back. So we're unclear as far as like how long that we're dealing with here. Now, I will make note that the Attorney General in their brief, and the one thing I'll take issue with, indicating a little bit more culpable than the facts in Miller, is that this occurred at night. Now, I could be mistaken, but I find no reference in the record that this occurred at night. Now, I understand, right around page 51, 52 of the Joint Appendix, there's multiple different questions of whether or not going, leaving me alone and that sort of stuff, mom, dad coming back at night, but I didn't find anything as relates to a time that this actually took place, whether or not this was at night or during the day. I don't think Mr. Dalloway mentioned that. I don't think Jacob Dillon was expressly asked that at all. So I take issue that this occurred at night because I think it's unclear from the record. As such, even looking at, even though using the dictionary definitions regarding abandoned, is different than unreasonable absence, because if an unreasonable absence is the court in, even if this was, the facts were almost identical to Miller, I still think the analysis for unreasonable absence would be a little bit different if the children are older. So I'm not saying that the result would be the same, but if an unreasonable absence that this court found was unreasonable in Miller, or approximately an hour and a half, even being conservative, if we're dealing with 30 minutes for an older individual, if that, we don't even know if that would fall under the definition of unreasonable absence, let alone abandonment. So even though unreasonable absence has something that's more of like lost, going away, you can't really explain why you're gone. Abandonment, even though they take issue with it, has something more of finality. Even when we're reviewing the code, when dealing with abandonment, we're doing like railways, ice boxes, corporate name changes, essentially leaving it aside. Even, and I don't profess to be an expert in property, but I mean, there's a difference between abandoned property, meaning it's essentially gone, versus lost or misplaced property.
Well, isn't the difference leaving children or a child and going away with no effort to tell them where to be? I mean, this is not a situation where parents are leaving kids at a movie theater saying, we'll pick you up after the movie. I mean, this was a scenario even... either way, he's left those children in a location, and evidence viewed in light most favorable to the Commonwealth, he wasn't there. He wasn't in the parking lot. The one child looked in the parking lot. They tried to call him. They finally got him on the phone. He then came back. So how does that not fit the definition of abandonment? Or am I missing something?
Well, Your Honor, I agree that he left. The record is very clear that he left, but what is unclear from the record is whether or not that was meant to be any significant period of time. Now, granted,
at this juncture, light most favorable to the Commonwealth, the only reason he came back was because the child called him to come back.
I don't necessarily agree with that with the record. That's what the child said.
But light most favorable to the Commonwealth.
Well, even in light most favorable to the Commonwealth, we also indicate we got Bunny Dalloway. The store, I don't know, manager or employee at the time didn't indicate that he actually, the child called and said that they eventually just came in and said he was sleeping in the truck. Now, granted, that's no way to corroborate that. It's just sort of like repeating what Mr. Tilley told them, but there's also no reference indicating that the child called. They just said they're looking for their uncle. Looking for whether a brief
period. Did the store employee ever confirm in any way his statement that, well, I told them I had to go, they wouldn't come to me, but I have to go and I'll be back. Is there ever any corroborating testimony?
There is not, Your Honor. Unfortunately, on what we're dealing with here, I mean, there's many things in the record that conceivably, I'm not saying that had the trial judge did something, a different sort of like analysis, or consider something else that might fit the bill under the misdemeanor child in need of services or contributing to the delinquency of a minor. But the trial judge, for whatever reason, indicated that it was only doing the abandonment at the store. So what we have is we got a very brief testimony, I think only a page and a half, maybe two, from Bunny Dalloway, and less than a page, I think, from Jacob Dillon, indicating what actually took place there. The Little Caesars are right around in that store area. And then Mr. Tilly's explanation about what took place. A lot of what, so there's very little as it relates to the...
But no testimony either as to, I'm an old guy, they wouldn't, these fairly good-sized kids were hiding from me and running from me, wouldn't come to me. So I called mom or dad to say, I can't get your kids to come to me. I've got to go home because I've got to go to the bathroom or I don't feel well or anything. Nothing that he ever called the parents and said, your kids are running wild and I can't do anything about it.
Nope. Just that his explanation was that he had to use the restroom, went home and then came back. That was his explanation. It's just one of those things that, and looking at it, there has to be some sort of like for, in viewing different terms, as the code has many different terms as far as abuse and neglect, child in need of services, and need of supervision, there has to be some sort of like delineation between the terms. And if we're dealing with unreasonable absence, as the court dealt with in Miller, there has to be something different from an unreasonable absence from abandonment. There has to be, otherwise it renders the term superfluous. So there has to be a different definition.
But the indictment could include both, because the indictment cites the code section and the arguments of the prosecutor, the closing arguments, talking about, again, recognizing, of course, this is a misdemeanor.
The least of his concerns.
Yes, that right now, I'm sure that was the prosecutor's least of the prosecutor's concerns at the time, too. But it could certainly encompass both 3 and 5. I mean, you addressed 3 and 5.
I do it for the sake of thoroughness.
Yeah.
But respectfully, Your Honor, because the trial judge did not really consider that, and you're going through the analysis, granted, it wasn't a complete analysis, but going through the varying theories of the Commonwealth as it relates to the misdemeanors, and considering that, said only abandonment. So if the...
But that was a motion to strike.
Right? It was. It was that motion to strike, and...
That wasn't...
Full candor, I mean, when it got to the guilty, it was a lot less discussion, just essentially... Finding guilty. If the court wanted to go down the unreasonable analysis, I think then the appropriate, even though I'm asking that it be reversed, I think the appropriate then situation would be for to essentially remand for almost like a new trial for the trial court to consider whether or not it fits the definition of unreasonable absence, because all it sort of dealt with was the abandonment at that point in time, leaving the kids at the store.
Can't this court determine that based on the law and the fact that the indictment and the order both reference just the code section?
The court could, Your Honor. I think where it runs into difficulties, like had the trial court not done any sort of analysis at all regarding the varying prongs, then I think this court is free to say, well, it could have fit multiple different theories. Here, the trial, at this court is bound by the record, and the trial judge is presumed to be correct, then we have one argument is that you have to presume that the trial court considered all the different prongs, and in the analysis at motion to strike said the only thing that is proper to go forward is the abandoned one.
And you don't see any way that reference was simply to the crime charged as opposed to...
It very well could.
Limiting the definition.
It very well could, but I think that the argument that I'm making is it's sort of like limiting that sort of like definition because that's what the trial court considered.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson for the Commonwealth. This court should affirm the conviction because the evidence was sufficient to show that the defendant either abandoned or unreasonably left the children at the store, rendering them abandoned or neglected.
Well, given that there's a difference, there has to be a difference between the meaning of the two, and the judge specifically used abandonment. I mean, doesn't that create a problem?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that, Your Honor. I think that looking at the context of the conversation that was happening at the motion to strike stage, the Commonwealth's two theories at that point were that the children were left and also that the children had been given some kind of pills. And the court said, I'm not going to let you go forward on the pill charges because those are just too risky, but I'll let you go ahead on the abandonment. I don't know that viewing the light most favorable to the Commonwealth and looking at the whole context of the trial, and admittedly, you know, there's not a whole lot of record on this misdemeanor charge because, as the court observed, there was a lot going on in this case. But I think in context, reading that, I don't know that it was a limitation of the theory between abandonment and unreasonable absence. I think that it was more of a loose term, more of almost a, not the pills, but okay on the abandonment. That could be an overly generous reading of the record on my part, but that's how I read the record. Even if I had the abandonment theory, I think only, you know, abandonment as in that prong of the statute, I think that the evidence is still sufficient because, you know, you get the word its normal meaning. In Miller, that was an unreasonable absence case. There, the mother was still in the general vicinity of that child. You know, the child was out in the parking lot at the Trader Joe's case. She's still in the general vicinity. She said, hey, watch my car, and presumably infant child, but she was still there. Here, Mr. Tilly left. And I think it's also important that the trial court credited the young boy's testimony, found that Mr. Tilly's testimony was pretty incredible. The young boy's testimony, JD, the boy who I think was 10 at the time, at the relevant time, said that they were at Little Caesars, and they knew that he had left them there because he said, I'm leaving you here. And my impression from the record was that this was all after dinner in the winter, and it was at night. If that was incorrect, I apologize. But that's my recollection of the record. And he said, you know, I'm leaving you here for whatever reason, and left the children.
And so they had eaten.
They had eaten.
Did they have any money to spend on anything there?
There was. So Mr. Tilly testified that they had some spending money, and his testimony was that he sent the kiddos to the stores to go spend their spending money to the dollar store or whatnot while he took a nap in the truck.
And then he tried to corral them, but he's kind of old and they're fast, and they ran and hid from him, and so
right.
He just said, I can't get him, so I'm leaving.
So he's leaving, and he had to go to the bathroom, so he's leaving.
That's his testimony.
That's his testimony.
And he doesn't even testify that I called the parents or said anything to them.
No. He said that he was going back home to do what he needed to do, and then he came back at some point, was his testimony, and it was all kind of vague. I also submit that, given the trial court's credibility findings, his story kind of degenerated as it went. You know, it got a little fanciful about the kids running around hiding in flower pots or whatnot, or in the shelves or whatnot. I mean, I've done a lot of babysitting. It could happen.
And that was not corroborated by the store employee.
No, it was not. The store employee, one of the cashiers, saw the children being a little rambunctious, was her words, got a hold of, I believe, the manager, who knew one of the children, and got them in his office and attempted to help them. So,
and he kept them there for
about half an hour, was his testimony. It's unclear from the record how much time passed between the time Mr. Tilly absented himself, left the children at the shopping center, and the children were gathered up by Mr. Dollarhide and put in that office. Mr. Dollarhide did say that it was winter, it was cold outside, it got dark early that day. So these children were there without any transportation, away from, you know, several miles away from home, it appears from the record, by themselves, and Tilly, viewing the record in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, Mr. Tilly left them. He wasn't there and asked somebody to watch them inappropriately. He didn't, you know, avail himself of the public facilities and say, hey, someone watch these kids. He didn't make an attempt to call the parents to come watch their rambunctious children. He just up and left. And those are the facts.
And like it was favorable to the Commonwealth, the only reason he came back is he was called.
He was called by I think the oldest boy.
The older boy.
Was the evidence in the record. And it's real apparent on the record that the trial court flat didn't believe Mr. Tilly's excuse, and that the evidence before the court, as the court determined it, was that Mr. Tilly just again, I hate to repeat myself, but he just left those children with no real explanation, whether from caprice or a bad motive or whatnot. And I submit that that's the kind of behavior that the statute goes to. You know, if you have a duty to a child, if you're watching the child in loco parentis, which certainly seems like that was Mr. Tilley's role, he was the adult who had taken the children out for dinner or whatnot, you have a duty to those children to actually render care for them, and you can't just up and leave those children alone with no transportation and no means of help. So if there's other questions, I'll certainly...
Can you briefly address the 5A18?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. I apologize.
Even though counsel acknowledges there may be an issue.
Yes, Your Honor. I usually rely on my brief for those things, but I'm happy to address it. There was some discussion about the statute at trial, but the specific issue that is raised on appeal, that this didn't fall into the statutory definition of abandonment, was never brought forward to the court. If that had been brought forward in the trial court, it could have been addressed there. The Commonwealth could have, you know, even if it was at the motion strike stage, the Commonwealth could have sought to reopen the evidence. There could have been argument to develop that issue and correct any possible problem in the trial court. And even though there's a similar, even if there are similar things raised, as the court knows, that's not sufficient to preserve a particularized argument for appeal. Most of what the argument was focused on at the trial court was credibility. This entire case, including the misdemeanor conviction, all came down to whether you believed Mr. Tilley or whether you believed the child witness. And here, it's pretty plain that the court found Mr. Tilley's testimony incredible. So I submit that that is not preserved in the record. There's other questions I'm happy to address. If not, I would ask the court to affirm.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Sabin.
Just very briefly, just to address Judge Decker's earlier question to me as it relates to the unreasonable prong of it, whether this court could address it. Even if this court got to the point and wanted to go through that analysis, there still has to be some sort of distinction. I mean, as a court is well aware, going through Miller, going through the different factors, looking at the age and the varying things, the court has to take all that into account. And obviously, it just said a young child in Miller, but I sort of got the impression that it was just sort of like left there. It was an impression it was much younger than 10, 11, 12 years of age, as is the situation here. Left in a car running for a period of time, then the vehicle was turned off, keys removed from the situation. A lot more vulnerable child in the situation there in Miller. At least I got that, at least from the appearance of what is addressed there. In this court's decision there in Miller. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll